Good afternoon. I'll probably take a little bit less time. I'll run through it fairly quickly. I don't need to belabor a lot of this. I think you will see that I have been dealing with some interesting situations, so it's probably good that we're very far past lunch already. So sort of the crux of my research as a whole and what I'm going to talk about a little bit is looking at these different factors of what's happening with these potential bacterial pathogens that could be coming out of this type of a media source or agricultural waste or how we're going to look at it. And for today, I'm going to specifically focus on aspects of regrowth and what happens when we get into the second stage of these types of piles. So just some very basics. Obviously, in agriculture and the environment, we realize that mortality and waste management is something that we definitely need to focus on, because animals will die, animals excrete manures, we want to reuse these manures, obviously, and we need to do this safely. Now, these sources at the same time can harbor these potential bacterial pathogens. They can harbor transmissible spongiform encephalopathies. They can harbor viruses. Okay, so there's very, very much diversity on these very nasty things that can be in these sources. The one stat I have there is for emerging zoonoses, about between 12 to 24, maybe a little higher by now, 25% of global infectious diseases are caused by these types of bacterial and viral and other pathogens that could be coming out of these sources. Now, when we need to deal with these, we need to deal with them in a very safe manner. In the past, what we've used has not been very efficient or very good, such as rendering. A lot of times we don't have those facilities available, or it's expensive and different producers can't afford them. Freezing, obviously, is not practical, especially in a lot of locations. Burial is just hiding the problem until it comes back to haunt us a little bit later. Dumping, you know, dumping over the back hill, as they say, is something that's quite common, but that just spreads it around even more. And then I put incineration on as just one of those high energy intensive methods that we use. So basically what we need to do is use something that's quick, cost effective, and obviously safe. So the term biopiles is kind of newer for a lot of this type of work. It's basically just exactly this, creating a somewhat looking compost pile, but it's based with, in this point, livestock mortality, slaughterhouse residuals, roadkill, that sort of thing. So biopile management is pretty much the same as the way we would approach composting. Okay, we're looking at two phases, where our initial phase is the real high decompositional phase. In this case, it lasts about 60 days. Second phase, obviously, we're trying to decrease the bone matter coming out of animals. We're trying to stabilize this product, this biopile product or compost product. We're measuring everything like we always do, temperature, oxygen level, carbon to nitrogen ratio, water content. We're trying to keep all of the parameters in the proper composting areas as the guidelines say. The only difference between a composting process and a biopiling process is that in this case, because we're dealing with some potential pathogens that could even become airborne, we tend not to turn the pile for an extended period of time, anywhere from 2 to 6, upwards of a year, sometimes a year and a half. So obviously the problem is that if we are using this type of method, if we are using this method to degrade all of these potential pathogens, then we can run into a problem if the method is not 100% efficient in the sense that it causes regrowth. And if these potential pathogens regrow, then obviously they are a potential risk to humans and animals. Now, in trying to look at this, obviously it's very impractical to analyze and assess everything, just due to the difficulty of doing these analyses, due to time, due to the expense, due to their pathogenicity, and at the same time, because a lot of them are quite present in the environment at various times, based on strain. So in this sense, it's been alluded to in a couple presentations already, we tend to focus on indicator bacteria or indicator microorganisms. And in this case, I'm only going to focus on the work that I did with E. coli or Streptococcus faecalis. And while approaching this, the idea is that these two different bacteria should have different properties and should exhibit different properties based on the fact that they are different. Okay, so this is obviously a lot of information. I'm only going to touch on a few things. It's just a comparison of our coliforms here, in, sort of in the center column, and then down here we've got our Streptococcus faecalis or enterococci. And while a lot of different properties are the same, okay, such as both of these two classes of bacteria don't form spores or that sort of thing, there are some very obvious differences. And that's what the five red arrows are. So one, we've got coliforms as rods. One, the other one is spheres, you know, nice and simple. One is gram-negative, one is gram-positive. Okay, so these are very distinct differences. Some of the other main ones that come into play, you know, we're talking about one being able to grow in salt water, one not being able to grow in salt water for the most part, differences in pH, that sort of thing. But if anything, I would draw you to the very bottom arrow here. We tend to consider the coliforms as fairly resistant bacteria or fairly resistant pathogens, whereas we consider the streptococci as very resistant microorganisms. So, as I mentioned, the objective of this work was to mainly look at this aspect of regrowth in the environment in these types of biopiles, and also to try to differentiate and see if we can see any trends between the primary phase and the secondary phase of biopiling. So how do we do it? Well, in this sense, we built a fixed environment. Okay, so we've got replication. We've got three individual cells here. Within each one of those cells, there's a soil layer that was put in, locally obtained soil. The cells were constructed in a way that everything going in can be accounted for. So there's a central drain in the bottom of the cell that goes down to a sampling hut where everything can be sampled or disposed of to a local sanitary sewer so that we're potentially sending these potential pathogens to a proper disinfection area. We tended to consider these as biosecure. Okay, so we took every precaution we possibly could in the construction of it. I won't go into detail with a lot. But at the same time, while making it biosecure, we tried to mimic what we would see in a natural environment as best as we possibly could. Okay, so this was only one part of a larger experiment. Now, just a couple pictures to show you how much fun it is to deal with this waste. Obviously, it is research and that sort of thing. The gentleman here with the bucket that's full of something, which you'll see in a second, he's smiling because he knows what I'm about to encounter. Okay, so I use this picture for two reasons. One, yes, we're dealing with this type of source, whether or not it's a whole animal, roadkill, or if it's coming from a slaughterhouse, such as this material. But what you can see here is that inside this cell, okay, so it's a fairly large cell, about 6 feet by 10 feet. Okay, underneath there is a soil profile, about a foot deep sort of thing to get some filtering in. We wanted to see how the soil would play a role. Then what you see here is about a foot and a half of sawdust. Okay, so this is the base of our biopile, or the base of our compost pile. And then obviously all of the waste goes on top. Now, I mentioned, again, I just draw you back to my intro slide, it's not very nice stuff. Yes, this is me in the cell. Yes, that is me gagging over the side of the cell. Okay, it's different work, but you know, having gone through it once, I may not be shy to do it again. And then this is just a picture of what the final biopile looked like. Okay, so another foot to a foot and a half of sawdust was put over top. We use sawdust and we use the thickness to absorb the different liquids, but also to absorb a lot of the odors that are given off. Okay, sawdust is very good at absorbing those. So we end up with this nice kind of windrow-looking pile. Now, within this pile, we approached it very systematically. So if you look at this diagram on the right, this is sort of looking from the end. Okay, we had thermocouples at various levels within that pile. We had it below, in the middle of the waste, and just above the waste, so we're able to get a very good sort of spatial measurement of temperature dynamics and that sort of thing. When you look at the left-hand picture, okay, these six thermocouples, let's say, there would be six at three different horizontal locations. So we were able to get a good idea of what was going on throughout the entire pile, the center of the pile, the outsides, to see if we could see differences there. And then we also had soil moisture and soil temperature probes in the ground. So we tried to get this whole comprehensive picture. So some of the measurements that we had, obviously temperature, soil moisture, soil temperature, biopile temperature, that sort of thing. Pathogen fate, you know, I use that term loosely, obviously, just as a brief description. the effluent that was coming out, so every bit of effluent that was coming out of these piles was collected, was sampled, was quantified, and was tested for the different bacterial indicators we were looking at. And as well, we tried to monitor a whole wide array of these different environmental parameters, weather conditions, temperature, light conditions, that sort of thing. To do a lot of the work, we did not use any molecular-based techniques. It wasn't necessarily the focus of the bigger project. So we did use classical membrane filtration techniques, various different types, different media for different organisms. I had some fun incorporating some Petrifilm media into the experiment, which is what this diagram is. Okay, Petrifilm had just been released for environmental analysis, had just been approved, I should say. So I had some fun to see if I could see comparisons and that sort of thing. And as I mentioned, I'm only focusing on E. coli and Streptococcus faecalis. I point those out just because I tend to use the acronyms EC and SF in some of my diagrams. But there were a lot of others measured as well. Okay, so general results. We went in expecting these two different classes of bacteria to exhibit different characteristics, and they did. Okay, whether or not it was based over time, whether it was based on soil moisture, temperature, other conditions, we did see some very distinct differences. What this then told us is that we cannot use some of those traditional bacterial ratios that are sometimes used to make assessments. Whether or not it's, let's say, a fecal coliform versus enterococci, or throw salmonella in there. This sort of threw this whole theory out the window, which has been sort of an interesting result. And then after looking at some of the results and some of the diagrams and tables as they came up, it became apparent that we needed to start to ask these questions. You know, what was E. coli doing? Was it persisting or was it something else? What was Streptococcus faecalis doing? Was it just dying off and magically appearing, or did it actually regrow? So again, just looking at one of the environmental parameters, this is just a biopile temperature picture. Okay, so I thought I'd point this out. So you can see within 1 to 2 days of building this nice biopile with that nice nutrient source, yes, we did get temperatures very high. These temperatures are averages of all of those 18 thermocouples that were in those biopiles. We actually saw temperatures upwards of 75 at some zones. So we got some very extreme microbial activity right away. And then over the course of about 4 months, we had this drop-off. Obviously, you know, the elephant in the room is this big dip right here. This is where we removed the thermocouples, turned the piles, and started the secondary phase of this biopiling or composting activity. Now, when we started to look at the bacteria a little bit closer, we found that, yes, the levels were definitely dropping off in the effluent we were collecting over time. However, we were finding they were not totally being eradicated. There was always a small population that persisted. What we did find was that there was a very extended risk due to these potential pathogens because they were based on moisture leg events. So a lot of the loads that we were getting, a lot of the presence of the bacteria were quite highly associated with precipitation events, and then over the course of 2 to 3 days, depending on the size of an event, we would see a continual flow, which raised another question for us about how to look at other methods to actually get 100% eradication for various measures. Specifically, just looking in the liquid media, we did see exponential decreases of E. coli from the very start. So we saw some very high numbers, which I'll show you in a second, and a very, very fast drop off. And then again, coming to this idea of regrowth, we found this aspect of an exponential increase in growth by Streptococcus faecalis near the end of the active phase, which was something that wasn't expected, just sort of popped out. And obviously, just one little bit of stats, we did see a lot of very strict significant difference between all aspects of the experiment. So we saw full, complete differences in behavior. If we look at this graph, okay, on the right-hand vertical axis, these are just colony-forming units. So you can see we're going up to a maximum of about 80,000 per 100 mil. Okay, so quite high in this sense. Along the bottom is just time. I can point out right away this dotted line, which separates our active phase from our secondary phase. So that's where we turn the biopiles, that sort of thing. Now you're seeing two different colored dots. The red dots are total coliforms, and the blue dots are E. coli. Okay, so right away, you know, you can see obviously what looks here more like a linear decrease, even though I had been saying exponential. Well, there's a very good reason for that, is because this blip right here was associated with a tracer inoculum that I added to the biopiles. It was a nalidixic acid resistant bacteria to see if we could actually follow it quickly and understand something. We did not expect a minor hurricane to come through and flush everything out right away, which is why we got this big spike. So we can essentially remove that. And at the same time, we see a second peak right here. Again, that was associated with a second inoculation and a second precipitation event that flushed the bacteria through the system. So if we remove those two peaks, we do see this very nice exponential decline of the total coliforms and more specifically the E. coli. Once we turn the biopiles and go into the secondary phase, we somewhat loosely see a little bit. Total coliforms, we've got some higher numbers, but they're more prominent in the environment, so we kind of looked aside from there. But you'll notice that the coli almost looks like there was nothing there. These are not actually, in fact, zero values. These are very, very tiny values on the scale of about 100 coliform or colony-forming units or less per 100 mils. So this is just sort of pulling that out for E. coli just from the active phase, okay, removing everything else. Again, you can see here very clearly where we inoculated with the E. coli tracer. So if we pull that out, we can get down to a very low level, and we see this nice exponential decrease. Now, when we take the same time period and we switch our focus over to Streptococcus faecalis, so this is where the interesting part came up. Okay, obviously, right away, we did see a little bit of a blip at the start. So there was some Streptococcus faecalis coming out of those slaughterhouse residuals going into that pile. We were able to detect it at sort of fairly low levels compared to the level of the gram-negative bacteria. But you can see, obviously, we're going along, and then all of a sudden, we see this increase. Okay, the increase did not go up to the same level as total coliforms. Okay, we can put that aside, but yes, at the same time, we do see this very nice sort of curve going right up. And one thing I declined to point out on the previous graph, all of these dotted lines you see behind here are flow events. So this was the actual flow coming out of the biopiles on a daily basis. Okay, so you can see that we do tend to see a lot of a peak right away with a lot of these precipitation events and that sort of thing. So again, this was an unexpected result, which sort of led to a lot of future questions. Now this graph is just pulling the two bacteria side by side this time. So on the left-hand side, we have E. coli. On the right-hand side, we have Streptococcus faecalis. This is the time period during the secondary phase. Okay, so we've turned the piles. We knew when we left off previously that we had a very, very high level of Streptococcus faecalis. So naturally, we turn it within a day. We still would expect to see those higher levels. You know, once we turn, we reintroduce a shift or movement of nutrients around. We introduce some moisture. It was late in the fall. It was around this time a few years ago. We add air, so it causes everything to burst off again. But for the most part, we do see somewhat of a rapid decline over the last month and a half of this experiment. E. coli, on the other hand, you can see that we had really low numbers or almost nothing when we turned the piles, and for the most part, we don't really have anything left, and nothing really significantly popped out. So just to summarize that, again, we saw very, very strict differences in their behavior, which was very nice from a data standpoint. It was nice to have a lot of statistical validity in that sense. And yes, we did throw out this idea of any possibility of using bacterial ratios to make any type of a decision. Did E. coli persist? Did Streptococcus faecalis regrow? Obviously, don't know with certainty in any way. There's some more work ongoing to try to tap into this. But again, we did not see total eradication of anyone. Okay, so that more resistant Streptococcus faecalis was able to stick around and stay, and then when conditions must have been right, it took off again. But whatever that trigger was, we don't really know. Okay, so there was that sheer overlap. We do know that as the E. coli and total coliforms are at a very low level, conditions must have been proper for it to take off, which was a nice result. The very last bullet I have there, what were the reasons? You know, could the Streptococcus have been dormant? Could it have been in a spore? No, it doesn't form a spore. Could it have been there and we just weren't able to culture it, which is always the problem we tend to deal with these days? Were biofilms involved? Was it being protected by hiding in the inside of the soil layer and that sort of thing? It raised all sorts of questions. So I believe that takes me to the end. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer anything. The only things that did correlate were sort of the more general ones, like if we take, let's say, air temperature. Obviously, we turned the piles, it was around this time, you know, so it was, I think it was Halloween or November 1st, 3 years ago when I turned it. So obviously, temperatures had changed, moisture conditions were different. So we did have those different conditions. Yes, they did loosely correlate, but at the same time, you know, it's still a protected biopile environment, which is still somewhat protected from the outside environment. So we didn't give it a lot of weight. But otherwise, there wasn't anything that jumped out. I wish there was. I'd be up here pounding the podium saying it.